G'day, and welcome to the Fremantle Press podcast. My name is Holden Shepherd, and today I'm talking to the renowned author, academic, and crime novelist, David Wish Wilson. David Wish Wilson was born in Newcastle, New South Wales, but grew up in Singapore, Victoria, and WA. He left Australia age 18 to live for a decade in Europe, Africa, and Asia. He is the author of The Summons, The Coves, and three crime novels in the Frank Swan series, Line of Sight, Zero at the Bone, and Old Scores. His non-fiction book, Perth, part of the New South Book City series, was shortlisted for a WA Premier's Book Award. David lives in Fremantle and coordinates the creative writing program at Curtin University. Dave, welcome to the podcast.
Cheers, Holden. Great to be here.
Thanks for coming in. Look, let's talk about your novel. True West, this is such a great novel. I loved it. Not just because of all the Drawton references, by the way, which there are many of. But this is a really gritty novel set primarily in Perth in the 80s. We follow the 17-year-old protagonist, so we've got Lee Southern, through all these elements of the WA underbelly. So there's the bikies and those gangs and the drug underworld, but we've also got this element of the extreme nationalist movement that were kind of kicking in that era. Can you tell me, Dave, what was the inspiration for writing this book? Like, what made you want to write this particular era?
I suppose it's I've thought about some of these characters for a long period of time, and I remembered some stories I'd heard from Geraldton when I was a kid, from some friends. But really, it's just kind of the last 5 or 6 years, looking around the world, the way things are headed, in the rise of, well, populism, but also nationalist right-wing movements and that kind of thing. And that, I guess, made me want to reflect and go back and look at a little bit more at Australian history, particularly through the 20th century. And there is a kind of a long tradition of right-wing nationalist movements in Australia. We've flirted with it basically since the First World War. But this was something I hadn't seen written about in Perth specifically. And the late 80s kind of neo-Nazi scene, I hadn't seen anyone else write about this, and I wanted to think about that, what is happening now, but also start exploring what happened then. I was overseas at the time, but I remember, you know, when I was a kid, skinheads and getting chased and beaten up and all that kind of thing. So I wanted to look a little bit more at that kind of that culture, particularly as it eventually manifested itself in the Jack Van Tongeren kind of scene.
You know? Yes, and that's something you do talk about, I think, in the acknowledgements of the book. You address that specifically. Dealing with those themes like nationalism and white supremacy, it's particularly timely, as you say, given what, you know, we're going through in this decade. Can we explore a little bit more about, you know, the connection between what you've seen in the 80s and what's happening now? Like, when you decided to set this novel in the past, why did that appeal to you more than, say, setting it now?
I think because what's happening now seems to be a little bit more dangerous, because the right wing worldwide has tried to make itself a little bit more palatable. So they've dropped the weird Nazi symbology and the uniforms and the goose stepping and all of that, all of the paraphernalia. Mm. They've tried to go more mainstream with their marketing and message. So I wanted to go back to that kind of particularly period, because that was it's a pretty significant time in Perth, I think. I've spoken to lots of Asian Australians over the last few decades, and they often talk about that as a particularly unpleasant time to be a Western Australian. And also it was, you know, just despite the fact that the kind of the way they went about it was very crude, the leafleting and all of that kind of thing. They didn't have the advantage of social media and chat rooms and all of that kind of thing. They did manage to have a pretty significant impact. And I read an article the other day that, so at some point the Japanese, who were the main investors in Western Australia at the time, started talking about pulling out or stopping investment. And I think that's when the state really leapt in and stepped on it, and there were long prison sentences as a result and that kind of thing. But I really want a mini exploration of that kind of period to reference what is happening now around the world.
I think that's really interesting what you say about not only the investment, because, I mean, that just makes me think that, you know, the government only cared when it became a capitalist matter. You know, like, we're going to lose investment, so let's fix this issue. But around the idea that now these movements are dropping a lot of that imagery and that symbolism, so it's harder to identify who is actually part of this extreme right movement or whatever. Do you think that leads to people perhaps like Lee in the book Obviously, his circumstances are a little bit different because he's kind of dragged into this world through other means. But do you think that leads to people getting drawn into these movements without, you know, like, I feel like they're kind of drawn in without knowing the extent of what they're in. And then, like Lee, you kind of get to the point where you're like, oh, this is really, really dark stuff. This is really bad.
Yeah, so he's had his own particular upbringing, which we can talk a little bit about. But in a sense, he's vulnerable to that kind of message because he's a classic kind of outsider. He doesn't really have his people yet. He's still trying to work out where he fits in the world.
Mm.
As it turns out, he's not kind of, his head isn't turned by what's going on there because he doesn't respect the people because of his upbringing, I suppose. But yeah, it's certainly the case that, you know, so there's a description in the book of, you know, some people came to it because of the music and the parties and all of that kind of, and I grew up with people like that.
Mm.
And yeah, the music was quite important, I think. And other people, the same kind of characters who end up joining bikie gangs, just outsiders looking for a bit of community, lost boys, trying to find their kind of people. And I mean, it's probably fair to say though that the Jack Van Tongeren movement, they were marginal figures themselves. They were outsiders. They never really kind of cut through with either their messaging or their popularity. Mm. They did run for elections, which was and got some reasonably significant votes in a couple of elections, alarmingly enough.
Mm.
But they never really. I've been privy to some information where, you know, as an ex-military man, you know, they did try, and this is where it would have become really dangerous. They did try and lure ex-servicemen, particularly leaders, trying to create a broader movement. But fortunately, and this is indicated by all the research I've done about, you know, white nationalist movements in Australia over the last 100 years, they're generally peopled by unstable characters. So these things tend to pop up, become organised for a while, lots of enthusiasm, and then they fall away again for a period of time.
Mm.
And that's a classic. That was a classic case during the 80s, and it was stepped on by the government. I guess the dangerous thing now is it's more diffuse. You can become part of an online community with people spread all over the world and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's the scary thing, and especially when it moves into the political realm. So I know that kind of Lee comes in and he's kind of going, well, I'm more of a survivalist than a fascist, and that's not my scene necessarily. But people like Robbie or Brad in this book, right? Like, they say some stuff and I'm like, Jesus, like it's full on and it's quite chilling. What role do actual, you know, politicians, and not just in the book, but also currently, what role do those politicians have in either kind of quashing those ideologies and those movements, or actually like lighting the fire to spark them further?
Yeah, that's a good and important question, I think. So right from the 1920s in Australia, there was a small population of people who were, they were interested in fascism, they were interested in right-wing politics and that kind of thing, but they always been pretty marginal, like I said.
Mm.
However, they were a significant enough population for politicians to want to, in some cases, garner their vote. Particularly during the 1940s, 1950s and 1960s, and particularly in places like Queensland and Western Australia, it looks like there's some evidence to suggest that they weren't necessarily encouraged, but they weren't discouraged because they were also fighting the same kind of enemy that the government was. You know, it was an anti-communist time. It was a period of the Cold War, and these people were virulently anti-communist. So there was some kind of common cause, and these people felt like they were integrated and included. That's what it looks like anyway. Then in the 1970s and 80s with, the rise of neoliberal economics and globalisation, these people who had felt like they were part of this Australian community, and their values were recognised, they became kind of marginal, even more marginal and largely unimportant.
Mm.
And that kind of made them a little bit more dangerous. And we saw that with the sudden rise of Pauline Hanson. It's not an insignificant thing that she came from Queensland.
Mm.
That community, her community, her people have always been there.
Yes.
But they were quiet for a period. So it was when she came along, as you remember, pretty significant time in the Australian Parliament. But the Liberal Party did what the conservative side of Australian politics had always done, and that is they brought them into the fold by dog whistling and all of that kind of thing. So yeah, it's something that you can see all over the world, this populist messaging to kind of capture that the rump of the right wing, you know, and it's troubling.
It is troubling to see it kind of unfolding around us now, especially when we see, like in this book, an example of it not in, you know, the very recent past. In terms of someone like Lee in this book, I think there was a real turning point when he's dealing with the Vietnamese man. Brad's had a go at him and Lee's gone, no, I've got to take this guy to the hospital. And he doesn't take him to the hospital, but he takes him to the parents' place. What was that important for you to include to distinguish Lee's character as someone who's redeemable?
Yeah, I guess it served a double function. It's, you know, it's kind of right in the middle of the narrative. Prior to that, he's been involved with, he's started robbing banks for these people as a way of, I guess, gaining some kind of currency with them so that he can, you know, renew his relationship with his father. So he's been kind of blackmailed in a sense. Mm. But up until that point, most of the damage that he's seen has been stuff like the racist pamphleting and the stickers insulting to people. Mm. But there hasn't been anything really manifest. So that's a moment where he sees a genuine person who's been harmed. So this is the kind of the ugliness behind the rhetoric revealing itself, and that puts him in a position where he has to act. Mm. And despite his kind of unusual upbringing, he's generally a humane kind of kid. And so he makes a decision. As it turns out, he doesn't have to, you know, without giving too much of the story away, he doesn't have to completely remove himself from that group. You know, he's allowed to take this guy away and care for him. So, yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned the unusual upbringing he's had, because that was something I wanted to ask you about. What struck me in this novel was how much kind of damage the generations of Southern men had done to each other. Like, it's a really interesting kind of storyline. You let that kind of four generations of lineage kind of unfold. Was exploring the father-son relationships something that you really wanted to do going into writing this particular book, or did that just develop out of the characters?
No, it just developed out of the characters. So, I mean, I never really start with a plot. I just start with a character. And literally, in this case, it was a character in a truck driving to Perth. I didn't really know what was going to happen beyond knowing that I wanted to explore something about that. But at the same time, yeah, it's something that was born home to me actually a couple of years ago. I was commissioned to write, and I'd thought about it before, but this is where it really kind of crystallized for me. You know, I was commissioned to write the text for a war memorial, and it was a wish for peace. So it was like an anti-war message, I suppose, for the City of Canning War Memorial. Mm. And it was only 100 words. But part of that was, you know, I went out and spoke to war veterans. So, you know, my father's a Vietnam veteran, and I spoke to an Aboriginal, you know, war veteran, my brother's an ex-soldier, and I spoke to a couple of other people. And I said, well, what does war mean to you in terms of it's the harm that it causes and the damage that it's done and that kind of thing? And they all said basically the same thing. You know, it's not so much the damage done to the soldier, it's the damage done to their families. And it's an intergenerational thing, because those children who are you know, bashed by their father who's lost control, you know, that gets visited down the kind of the generations. Mm. So, yeah, it's true. So Lee, in effect, is, you know, his father's a Vietnam veteran, and he's pretty clearly been damaged by that experience. But also, as you say, there's two other generations. So Lee's great-grandfather is a convict brought to Western Australia. Mm. I guess that's quite an interesting thing about Western Australia, the fact that it was the last place in Australia to take convicts. And even in the 1930s, in some cases the 1940s, when my grandparents were around, you had people who had been chained and flogged walking around Perth streets. So it's pretty recent history, really.
I had no idea it was that recent.
Well, the ones who lived into their 70s and 80s would have been, and a lot of these fellas were, you know, homeless, living in humpies by the river and in institutions and that kind of thing. Wow. So Lee's great grandfather is one of these guys, and he's just gone out into the bush and stayed there, tried to create some kind of life for himself. Mm. But it's a hard life, and he's demanded a certain kind of toughness, and that kind of masculinity is very interesting to me. This idea that I mean, most, I think it's probably true of most Anglo-Celts in Australia. Our grandparents' generation were pretty poor, largely uneducated, and by and large they brought their children up to be tough because, you know, it was a tough world and you needed to be tough to survive in that world.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily the case now, but we're still seeing the effects of that kind of masculinity in the streets around us all the time. So I wanted to explore that a little bit as well.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I think, even examples of, for example, you talk about Lee having the grenade under his pillow as his dad Jack puts that under there to be like, to scare the shit out of him, really, and make him conform, behave. That's full on. And yet he doesn't see that as abuse. That's just normal. That's what a guy goes through, and that's toughened him up.
Yeah, that's right.
That's his kind of masculinity.
That's right. So, you know, Lee's father is convinced that Australia is going to be invaded. And I've met a couple of people like that. I remember them from the 80s. There was this fear that Australia was going to be invaded by Indonesia or China, and some people did organise themselves into these weird paramilitary groups. So because he's convinced that Australia is going to be invaded and he has gotten Lee's mother out of the picture, Lee is kind of a project for him. You know, he has kind of sole control over Lee's destiny the way he sees it, and he wants to bring him up to be a bit like a Spartan, I suppose. Someone who is able to control their fear, someone who is able to control their appetites and impulses to be the perfect kind of soldier so to survive in this, semi-apocalyptic scenario coming forward.
And I guess it does, I mean, it kind of doesn't work in a healthy way, but if you look at Lee, the way he deals with everything, I mean, he ends up just using drugs to kind of keep going. Like the very first scene, I think, he's on speed. He's on speed, isn't he?
Yeah.
And, you know, he's using heroin throughout. Like drugs play a big role in sustaining that, right?
Yeah. And that's been my experience of Australia. It's, you know, the drug culture's always been pretty strong. And certainly some of the people I remember from that kind of scene. So Lee's father's drug of choice is amphetamines. And to the point where he's often deranged by that, which strangely fuels his paranoid fantasies even more. Lee's doesn't really understand that as a kid. He's a little bit wary of it. So when he becomes kind of a captive of this white nationalist group, he's been so badly injured that he's treated, I suppose, with opiates, and then that just becomes part of his day to day life as a way of, like you say, of coping and getting through it all.
And it's interesting the use of the tow truck as a metaphor, I thought, because there's a tow truck kind of business. My understanding is that you used it from a very pragmatic place, because I think someone you spoke to mentioned how there's a link between the towing industry and the underworld. But I thought it was a really cool, it was a cool metaphor for a lot of things in the book, like people being dragged along into something they don't want to be, towed along. Lee's very much towed along by his dad and then towed along by this white nationalist group. Was there kind of a dual thing going on here, the symbolic meaning and also the literal meaning?
Very, very well spotted, but that's good. No one's asked me about that yet, but you're absolutely right.
Awesome.
when I knew that I wanted whoever it was who entered this kind of neo-Nazi world to be an outsider, but not a complete outsider. So Lee's got this very unusual kind of upbringing, But when he arrives in Perth, he needs a source of income. So he decides to be a tow truck driver based on a memory he had. And this goes back to when I was working as a teacher at Casuarina Prison. And one of my students who was due to get out, I said, what are you going to do? And he said, I'm going to go back to being a tow truck driver. And he had this strange light in his eye. And so I said, oh, yeah, so what's going on there? And his answer was kind of disturbing and kind of interesting. He said, yeah, you get to help people out and you meet people on the worst day of their life sometimes. Traffic accidents are pretty horrible and you get to help people. And I thought, oh, that's nice. And he said, you also get to see a bloody lot of mayhem. And that's okay, you're right. But he said mainly it's, tow truck drivers see everything. They know what's going on, and there's always been kind of strong underworld links with tow truck drivers. And this is actually something we're seeing in the media at the moment. I don't know if you've seen it the last couple of days.
No.
Images of tow truck drivers competing to get a job, and I think people being charged from the emergency service for leaking information to tow truck drivers.
Oh wow!
All that kind of stuff. So So a lot of people, have told me tow truck driving in the period when this novel is set was, you know, the means of communication again were different. So it had to be done by phone call, and there were no mobile phones, and so the competition was actually done on the spot, and it was physical. And sometimes people would fight over a broken car. So you got someone broken down, and two big burly men laying into each other with tire irons and stuff. And so Lee's decided to set himself up as a tow operator, but as was the case in those days, it was a pretty competitive business. So he soon finds himself in a bit of a sticky situation that, in his naivety, because he's only 17, he probably hadn't anticipated.
No, and those scenes at the the first few kind of chapters where he is, you know, kind of doing the tow truck circuit, something I really noticed was that the sense of it being set in Perth as an urban landscape was really strong. I'm like a town planning geek from way back. So every time you mention like, oh, it's the Canning Bridge or it's this street or it's that street, I was like, this is cool. I don't read many books where it's set in Perth and you actually, you know, you get a really strong sense of where it physically is. So I thought that was really cool. And I noticed you've got the book Perth obviously released a little while back. Is there something about Perth as an urban setting that inspires you, that makes you want to kind of explore this space?
Yeah, I think so. When I first started writing crime novels in Perth, part of it was a frustration that there were so few books set in Perth. I mean, I really couldn't think of any more than the fingers on my hands, novels that had been set here that that I was aware of. So when I started it, because you don't know where your readers are when you release a book, and because Perth has kind of been traditionally so unrepresented, I tried to foreground the descriptions of the place so people could get an idea of what this place is and how it feels and all of that kind of thing, to the point where I try in most of my stories to have the place as a bit like a character in itself. And in doing the research around, particularly for writing the Perth book and the research for all the crime novels, I've become fascinated by the place and its specific history. I mean, every city has an amazing history. But the things that I guess come through in novels like this and in the rest of the crime novels is a kind of atmosphere. You know, it's a big sprawling city with a big sky, with large spaces and a sense of space and silence. And that silence has a kind of a metaphoric resonance for me because of Perth's isolation, as a writer who looks at crime, because of Perth's isolation, there was always able to be silences around certain things. You were able to enforce a silence and you're able to keep people quiet who you wanted to keep quiet. And so things were done in a fairly open way because people didn't really expect to see it. There's a kind of a sense of innocence and naivety around the place, which allowed lots of cowboys over the years to pretty much operate in full sunlight. And I guess as you know, that harks back to that old, crime noir saying of as a description of Los Angeles, you know, the brighter the light, the deeper the shadow, or my favourite one, a sunny place full of shady people.
it really does lend itself, actually, as you describe it. It does make me feel like it's, you know, Perth is this Wild West kind of town. And it's, I think, certainly a good kind of place to set a crime novel. Something I wanted to ask you about was a particular quote that I found while reading the novel. So Lee's father planted all these seeds of survivalist kind of anarchist thinking. But there's one line that I found really interesting. So he says, "The only free man is the man who doesn't care." I just found that really interesting quote. And I wondered what that quote means for you within the context of the novel, but also, you know, more broadly, what does this mean? Like, is that true? How would you kind of filter that quote?
Yeah, so in the course of the novel, Lee's in a situation where he doesn't know whether he's going to live or die. And so he means it to be pretty specifically, if he doesn't care whether he lives or dies, then he's not going to be afraid of what happens. So it's about overcoming his kind of fear. But it's a good question because more broadly, I suppose it's about this idea of with the right wing and particularly the nationalist right, there's this freedom is a very important kind of concept, this idea of being free from people intervening and taking over and all of that kind of thing. And what that kind of freedom means. So in answer to your question, no, I don't think it is real because none of us are really free. We all have obligations and we love people and so we fit into a broader kind of fabric. But these kind of people, in their efforts to become free from outside influence, and in their striving for a kind of artificial purity, they're kind of closing themselves off from things like, well, as far as I can see, you know, conscience, shame. They're compartmentalizing their thinking, and that's kind of what I wanted that quote to explore as well. It's paradoxical, I guess.
It is, yeah, and it feels like, you know, in trying to lend itself to, oh, anarchy is the answer. It exposes the problems of that ideology and how much of an effect that ideology has on the people who subscribe to it. I just found it very interesting. Very interesting quote you inserted, so thank you. I want to also ask about the title. So True West works for me on, you know, multiple levels, at least three. Was there a particular reason you chose that title? Or
there were a few reasons. One, I just liked it, and I was very proud of myself because I can never come up with titles. I can quite happily sit down and write a 90,000-word novel, but I can never come up with two words to create a title. I came up with this one. It's not original. They're, you know, but it's really... So, you know, we live in the West, so there's that, like you say, there's a geographical reality. But in terms of its metaphorical meaning, this idea of a true North or a true West, there's this pure scientific, measurable thing. These people that I'm exploring in this novel, they're aiming for this kind of mythical idea of racial purity, this harking back to a time when whites were white and there were no outsiders and all of this kind of thing, which of course is manifestly false. Societies have always evolved over time, and as do languages and that kind of thing. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that, but also the idea of I guess it also has a resonance with that false social Darwinist rhetoric that usually, you know, applied to the concept of manifest destiny, that whites were a superior race and therefore would replace everyone else. The irony is, of course, the main rhetoric of the right wing now is anxiety about white people being replaced by other people. You know? So I wanted to cover all those kinds of things. I mean, one of the great things about the discovery of genetics is the recognition of how complex our genetic histories are. So the fact that, you know, just because I share white skin with someone, I might actually share more genes with an African man than with the white person sitting next to me. And there's that great story of David Duke, the right-wing American, getting his genetic test done and finding out he had African genes. I thought that was beautiful. So this whole thing of purity is actually a load of crap.
Absolutely, and that's actually explored in this. You touch on that with Lee and his heritage.
Yeah,
is that something you could talk to briefly, or is that something you intended to do in light of the white supremacist movement to kind of counterbalance that with Lee's character?
It's just a recognition that you know, our societies and our personal and family stories are always more messy, always more complicated than they seem on the surface. Particularly when you've got a history. You know, it's specific to West Australian history with the assimilation policies. A lot of Aboriginal people had to pass as white, or felt like they had to pass, otherwise they would lose their children or they wouldn't be able to get a job in certain types of professions and that kind of thing. So those kinds of, again, that's another kind of silence. It's bringing it out in a creative writing text, I guess.
It is, and it's done really well in the text towards the end. I won't kind of spoil exactly what happens, but it's a nice moment in the narrative.
Thanks.
I'm going to ask you to speculate. You don't have to. But having researched these kind of movements in the past, you know, you've seen, you know, what's happened in the 80s, and you've done some reading around this back to, as you said, 100 years ago. What would you predict might happen for us now? I mean, we're living in a time when these kind of tensions are rising, and we're seeing people increasingly polarized to the right and to the left. If you were to speculate, and I'm not saying you have to, but what do you think we would see next?
Well, I mean, I'm basically, I wax and wane between optimism and pessimism. I think if you look at European history, was it Norman Mailer in the 1960s who said fascism is the natural state of mankind or something like that?
Right.
I could be wrong with that. If you look at our history, so I, yeah, I, I look at the way people still today fate the idea of the royal family and the monarchy and all of that kind of thing, and it just fills me with dread, because I always associate it with not glamour and nice clothes and that kind of thing, but with a feudal system where your ordinary person was, you know, pretty terribly oppressed and all of that kind of thing. So I think there is a tendency in my culture to gravitate in difficult times towards the strong leader, and I think that tendency's always been there and probably always will be amongst a certain part of the population. It's easy not for that to happen when things are good and when everything's going well, but the real test of our society is going to be when things turn to shit and the idiot with the easy answers and the strong sense of conviction and the charm and the charisma to deliver that message repeatedly, whether it's true or as is likely manifestly false, that's going to be the real test of our society, I think. The signs are not great, I have to say.
Yeah, time will tell. Let's hope for the best. Thank you for gazing to the crystal ball for me. I threw you a curveball there. I'd love to shift gears and talk a little bit about writing itself.
Okay, good.
So you coordinate the program at the creative writing program at Curtin University.
Yeah.
You would see, I imagine, lots of exciting new voices coming through, but I also imagine you would see, you know, some new writers and emerging writers making the same mistake, you know, some common mistakes and common pitfalls over and over. I'm wondering what some of those, you know, what do you see?
Well, it's a topic of conversation amongst creative writing teachers I've noticed over the last 20 years. I think the main thing is people not reading enough. So that'd be my first thing. I always say, you know, read, etc. You don't expect a musician to start playing the guitar well without listening to music and all of the other kinds of stories. And that generally tends to work once people find authors that they like and they start to develop a voice alongside that writer or series of writers. The writing inevitably improves. But it's surprising how few creative writing students read a lot, as opposed to, say, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. And the other thing is, and it's related to developing the voice, it's not writing often enough, probably. It's the idea of waiting for kind of inspiration opposed to sitting down and just
getting it
just
done.
Doing it. And, you know, creative writing is a craft as much as it is an art. And, you know, like all crafts, you learn as you do. And it's certainly the case with writing. When you're working on a narrative, it figures itself out, but you've got to be there with it, with the material, as you well know.
Yeah.
And the main kind of mistake is not necessarily anybody's fault. It's so I'm pretty terrible. In my first class, I always say, if you set this short story assignment in America for no good reason, I'm going to fail you.
Just to keep them on their toes.
Yeah, that's right. Everyone goes, "Oh, really? What? I say, "Yeah, you're living in Perth, Western Australia. Don't set the story in New York using a kind of a CSI, something you saw on television structure to tell this story, you know." And so that's often a thing. People feel like their life is not authentic and they don't really have anything to tell. So it's a natural inclination to kind of mimic other forms. So I really try and strongly, perhaps too strongly, steer.
You fail them all.
Well, I never actually have done it, but I do say that.
That's a good threat.
I try and steer people away from that, just I think for good reasons.
I think it's a great decision. I think it's good advice. Definitely something you said about being there with the work is where you find, you know, what you're meant to do. I used to plan a lot, and long before I started really getting serious about novels, but I'd just spend ages planning. And I've noticed some of my friends who are students say, "Oh, I'm planning my book." And I'm like, I've now learned to say, "Don't plan, just do. Just start writing, you know, just start getting words down. And if it's crap, it's crap. But while you're with those crap words, you'll find the good ones."
Yeah, that's absolutely true from my experience. I mean, for a start, doing too much research and too much planning can be paralyzing in itself. You don't really know when to start. But also the fact that one of the things you learn as a developing writer and it's a great discovery to make, is how amazing the human brain is. So when you're working on something every day and you're thinking about it, your brain is working away even when you've stopped working. Mm. Your brain is working when you're making coffee. Your brain is working when you go for a walk. It's an exhausting part of writing. Your brain is working while you're asleep. Your brain is working when you're having a shower. And if you're living that kind of life, if you're really committing to a piece of work, when you sit down to write, depending on what your routine or ritual is, when you sit down to write the next day, it's kind of there, you know, without you having to consciously think about it. You learn to trust yourself a little bit. Some of those, every narrative, of course, is a series of problems with their own kind of solutions. Mm. And your brain is working. It's a problem-solving machine, I suppose, to put it crudely. Brain is working subconsciously to solve these problems. And that's something you can only really figure out by actually, like you say, sitting down and doing it.
Mm. That's so cool. I always think of it as like a game of chess, but you're playing it against yourself and you're trying to, like, if I do that, then what, like 20 million options will happen? And if I make that move, what will happen next? And your brain is constantly ticking over trying to work out, you know, you're trying to outfox yourself almost.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of advice for emerging authors, like myself, I'm going to be selfish here. You know, you've had several books out, successful author. Tell me your secrets. Like, tell me, you know, what works well? What should I do? What should emerging authors do? And what should we know to make our career as an author work out? What do we need to know? What do we need to do?
I think just do the work. I mean, it sounds glib almost, you know, but doing the work and finding your people, finding, you know, people who can support you, because it is a strange solitary activity. Finding people whose opinions you can trust to share your work with is just kind of invaluable. And, of course, determination and sticking with it. For some people, I don't know whether it's a blessing or a curse, some people are just driven to keep doing it regardless of all the setbacks, and that's great. But that kind of support network, when you do become disillusioned inevitably, and like I say, it's an exhausting process. With it, lots of ups and downs and lots of setbacks and knockbacks and all of that kind of thing. So just doing the work, trusting yourself, reading as much as you possibly can, finding writers you admire, and also finding your people who can support you along the way. And, you know, that's you've got a lot of the things there to get you started, I think.
And do you, when you talk about finding those people who get your work, do you do that? Do you find, like, you know, people who can beta read for you, or, you know, like your first readers who can tell you, yeah, this manuscript's great, or no, it needs work, or do you go straight to the publisher, or how do you kind of?
Yeah, no, I always show it the first draft stage, which is good because I get good feedback. I mean, I have my ultimate reader, I suppose, who was one of my teachers when I was at uni. And sometimes I show her the work still today, even though, you know, we've known each other a long time now. And sometimes I don't, but I always, her and an editor I worked with, I always think while I'm writing, so it's like they've become a voice in my head. What would they think about this? And so I kind of carry that with me. And then sometimes I just show this particular person, and her advice is always blunt when it needs to be, and it usually is, you know, usually she's right, and, you know, complimentary when it, you know, that's deserved as well. And then I've got a couple of mates who are just good on details, so know everything there is about popular culture, cars, guns, you know, music, all of that. They're important as well, because they always say, you know, that's just, I want to drive that car, mate, you know, like that, you so on and so forth. I've got a couple
that
of different
checkers almost.
And these fellows are not necessarily good for structure and all that kind of thing. But they're big readers, and they, you know, they're happy to help. So.
Whatever system you've got is definitely working for you. True West is a fantastic novel, and I've really enjoyed reading it. We've got time to hear from it now. If you'd like to share a segment from the book,
okay. Thank you. Thank you for those nice words. So, Lee, the novel starts off, and I'm just going to read the first couple of pages. The novel starts off with Lee having, he's committed a crime in Geraldton, which means he has to leave the town. He's grown up with this strange paramilitary gang of mostly Vietnam War veterans, and his father's gone missing, and he doesn't really know what's happened, but he fears that his father's been murdered. So he's committed a vengeful act, which is a little bit self-destructive, and it means he has to run. He basically has to flee to Perth. So this is just the first few hours of his journey.
Over to you.
Lee Southern drove with his palm against the steering wheel. He liked to feel the machinery blow in its tight iron constellation while he held the picture in his mind. The Ford F-350 felt like an extension of his body, and like him, it was 17 years old. Lee's father had bought it on the day that Lee was born. The minute he heard that Lee's mother was in labour, he drove to the Geraldton Ford dealership and bought the F-350 utility with its 351 Cleveland engine and straight green paint job. Lee rested his arm on the driver's sill and let his hand wobble in the wind. The sun was headed toward the horizon, and he could smell the baked limestone crests that rose and fell alongside him like the flanks of a snake. The floor of the Chewed and Banksia scrublands was covered in purple, blue, pink, white and yellow wildflowers. Spring was his favourite season, but he wasn't looking at the flowers today. Lee glanced in his wing mirror like he'd been doing the last 5 hours. They'd be coming for him if they weren't already, some of them on bikes, some of them in their tricked-up Landy four-wheel drives. The Knights would be coming as soon as they discovered their latest five-acre plantation had been destroyed, cropped to the base of the stalk and raked into mounds and set on fire with diesel. Lee still had ash and dirt and the smell of Mary Jane's smoke on his hands, jeans and T-shirt. He left the acreage before dawn, with the orange flames pumping flat gun smuts into the bluing sky. Lee patted the dash of the truck and eased on the accelerator. Just thinking about what he'd done made him speed. The Knights would be looking for his father's Holden Sandman, with its swirling death's head decals along the sides and its Knights 01 plates, bestowed upon Jack Southern as first president of the club. Now that Lee's father was missing, Lee had been ordered to return the plates to Greg Downs, the new Knights president and probable killer of his father. Instead, Lee had gone and torched their plantation. Lee put his hand on the wheel and felt the tappets beating their quiet rhythm and the pistons firing and all of it a controlled dance of fire and fuel. The Ford F-350 truck had been parked under a tarp at his Uncle Gary's block outside Dongara. It was unlicensed and untraceable, the perfect vehicle for him to escape in. Lee reached for the dash and took out a cigarette. The truck kept on straight without his hands on the wheels because of all the weight. It was fitted out to provide him with an income when he got to the city. Last week, Lee and his Uncle Gary had cut off the ute bed and replaced it with an iron sheet. There were blocks of pig iron ballast in the engine bay to balance out the home-crafted towing rig they'd bolted to the iron sheet. Onto that, Lee and his uncle had welded a winch scavenged from a Mack truck, a steel box filled with dollies and canvas slings and stands, chocks and jacks, a diesel generator and air compressor, air cushions taken from his father's 50-foot trawler, snatch blocks and spare chain, heavy-duty rope and steel cable, bridles and skates and arrow sticks, a shovel and broom and tarpaulin, a toolbox and first aid kit. There was a whine that became a throaty roar, and Lee took the wheel and stared in the wing mirror until he saw the riders. He was rolling at 100, but they were coming on him, two riders in black leathers floating through the silver heat mirage and leaning into the banking turn. Lee reached under the seat for his father's Luger pistol. Before his father owned it, his grandfather had ratted it from a German officer in North Africa. His grandfather had pointed it at the German officer, and because they were instructed not to take prisoners, had tested it on the officer's brain pan. The pistol was Lee's father's favourite. He brandished it at meetings and fired it down at the gun club and disassembled and cleaned it whenever he needed to think. Lee drove one-handed with the pistol aimed at his feet and looked back at the riders who'd moved out of single file and were now in tandem. He flicked off the safety and fingered the magazine that was supposed to hold 8 rounds, but because of the tight spring only held 7. The riders were signalling to one another. Lee's instinct was to speed, but the truck was top-heavy and cornered badly. He eased his foot and slowed to 80, and then 70, and held the pistol and calmed his breathing. The Luger was semi-automatic, and if he wasn't careful, he'd shoot out the magazine in seconds, and then he'd be unarmed. The road dipped into the crazed pastel colours of the coastal woodland. The only movement ahead was a raven swimming in the watery mirage with roadkill in its beak. Lee could see the city as a brown smudge on the southern horizon, and then the bikes were alongside him, and then they were ahead, and he didn't recognise the twin BMWs or the riders whose panniers were full of camping supplies. They were soon out of sight, and Lee immobilised the pistol and slipped it under his seat.
That was David Wish Wilson reading from the first opening pages of his new novel, True West, an absolutely hell of an opening to a book, I think. It's absolutely fantastic. Dave, thank you very much for coming and speaking with me today. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you.
Thanks, Holden. It's great.
When can we see this book out in the bookstores?
It's out on November the 1st.
November 1st. We will keep an eye out for it. And it's an absolute thrilling read, so well done again.
Thanks, Holden.
Cheers.
Cheers.